My name is Mae Brussel. The title of the broadcast is World Watchers, and it is program number 826. It is October the 5th, 1987. There was a group of people that met this past weekend for the Robinson Jeffers Festival. I don't know how many of you World Watchers are interested in Robinson Jeffers. I didn't recognize any of you there. You might have been there. But he happens to be one of my favorite poets, a very important poet. And it was very nice to spend Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon listening to some of America's really great poets talking about Robinson Jeffers and reading their poetry. An important thing about Robinson Jeffers is his concept about the world in general and the unique significance of California in terms of the world. And I think it's very pertinent to things that I'm seeing in the news all around me at this time. And since I've been studying history, I realize how important he is. The essence of Jeffers is that California is the place where Western civilization, he says, reaches its geographical, intellectual, and spiritual end. And he thought of himself as a product of civilization. And I'm citing a book about Robinson Jeffers that summarizes him better than I could in paraphrasing it. And that as an artist, he wanted to acknowledge the fact of what the Western Star meant that directed people west. He said that light guided civilization in its long migration out of Asia into the Mediterranean, into Europe, across the Atlantic, across America, and then right back to the Pacific shore. And he asked, where will that lead us now? And Jeffers was a person who felt that the past and the history of the past was wrong. It didn't make sense. And that Western civilization was coming to an end. He saw that after World War I and wrote about it. He said revolutionary discoveries in almost every area of thought and expression along the violent upheaval of World War I rendered inadequate many of the assumptions about life engendered by Greco-Roman Judeo-Christian tradition. And certainly World War I was an insane war. World War II was worse. And now we're on the verge of World War III. He said that these assumptions that we had before are inadequate and that life is not as described for the causes or reasons for these wars. And he said people believed the tradition would have to be abandoned. He and his friends and fellow poets felt it was necessary to abandon tradition or at least transcend it in order to recover authenticity and truth. And this is what we have to do at this time when there are so many lies going on in the newspaper every single day and disinformation. And along with T.S. Eliot, who wrote The Wasteland, Eliot felt that the great ideas and monuments of the past have been reduced to a heap of broken images, and that where cities once stood, and he cited Athens, Jerusalem, Alexandria, Vienna, and London. You could say Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York, if he could see them today. They've all become unreal. And in describing the world, T.S. Eliot and also Robinson Jeffers thought it was a state of mind, pardon me, that you have to get away from the backward look behind the assurances of recorded history. And that is very, very important as we share history each week on the air. This unusual project of sharing it with you every single week for 16 years, that you have to get over what is called the recorded history and get some sanity in what Jefferson, T.S. Eliot, and others referred to as a primitive terror, which is a sophisticated emotion involving the humbling of oneself before the mystery of existence, not having all the answers that Judeo-Christian religion have, but the mystery of existence, and be able to surrender your presumptions and be willing to look at life with a more innocent view. None of this is certain, and you're in trouble when you accept the history that's been handed to you. And as I say, I enjoyed Saturday going to the festival and hearing poetry in the morning and afternoon. It is good for the soul, and it's a very good balance to the research that I do or that any of you do when you listen to this broadcast, to have these kinds of balances and be in tune with some of the greatest minds in the world, particularly one that created right here in our own area and described so well, starting just during the period right after World War I, to what we're seeing today. He understood it perfectly. And there were several, a group of five renowned poets who read at the group meetings, and two of them were Pulitzer Prize winners, two or three. It was really a wonderful day, and maybe next year, if you see it, I'll tell you in advance, and you may want to share that with me. Well, today is an anniversary. It's October the 5th. It's the anniversary of the landing of Eugene Hasenfuss, the Southern Air Transport, left in Nicaragua, and it dumped it, rather, in Nicaragua, left El Salvador October the 5th. And since that date, we've had a lot of Iran-Contra to separate. The assumptions we've had, the history we've had, the history we're going to have, has to be all checked and balanced, and it has to be based upon some of your own innate knowledge, not what these pathological liars would have you believe. One day before the plane dumped Mr. Hasenfuss in Nicaragua, the Southern Air Transport had a crash in Texas. And this was a Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio. It was transporting arms to the Contras. And immediately, I believed that something was going to happen in terms of what unloaded later, because a gentleman on that airplane who died was Leon Mulcahy. I've tried to find out if he's related to Kevin Mulcahy. Kevin Mulcahy was the man who was murdered just prior to the trial of Edwin Wilson. And this airplane went down in Texas with Leon Mulcahy. Kevin had a brother, two brothers, and a father in the CIA. And the following day is when four people flew off from El Salvador, and three of them were killed, and one survived, Mr. Hasenfuss. And with those consecutively, one day after the other, I just, not instinctively, but realized this whole story was going to link to Stanford Technology Trading Group, to the Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple operation in Los Gatos, the Albert Hakim operation, the original Otto von Bolschwing network, and the early broadcast, I referred to it as the International Fascista, and now more and more material is coming out along those lines, finally. The unanswered questions about these incidences the first 2 days will remain never part of Bob Woodward's story or William Casey's, and I'll do more about that later, because I gave Danny Sheehan back in February the question about Leon Mulcahy. Was he related to Kevin? And also the fourth person on the airplane that crashed when the airplane from El Salvador went or was destructed over Nicaragua. The name of the fourth person, I can't verify, just a obscure name was given in U.S. News, a one-sentence report that I had on the air. But for all purposes, the Leon Mulcahy, October 4th, 1986 crash, has never been confirmed or denied, and I've tried different sources to find out, including Representative Henry Gonzalez from Texas. And also the third person who died on the airplane that blew up over Nicaragua. There was a CIA gentleman, William Stewart, very high up in the intelligence operations in Southeast Asia with the secret team. There was a William J. Cooper and a third person, but the parts left out of these stories are these other names that may take it to a different dimension or place. So at the time that this airplane was blown up in Nicaragua is a time that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and Mr. Cave and Secord were opening a second channel in Frankfurt, Germany, October the 5th, and when Robert McFarlane of the National Security Council was taking a Bible and a cake to Iran for the Ayatollah. There was an Iranian interviewed on television this week, I forget who was making fun of Ronald Reagan. They said the Bible was written in English and not in Farsi, and it was a joke to everybody, autographed by the president. And the cake they threw away because they thought there might be poison, and they have a good healthy paranoia because it just might have been laced with that kind of CIA acid or whatever. So they threw the cake away. That was smart. And also the story began to unfold at that time when Mr. Hasenfuss had the names of people high up in the White House directly linked to George Bush, the vice president, and then within a short time, the Lebanon newspaper broke this story. And I'll do more about that in one moment. Last week on broadcast 825, I was talking about William Casey, cited in Bob Woodward's new book, Veil, The Secret Wars of the CIA, being recruited by William Donovan in 1943 for the purposes of putting the OSS in Berlin, into the Gestapo offices, etc. Before the war was over, a month before the war was officially over, in 1943, Fritz Kramer recruited Henry Kissinger. In 1943, Alan Dulles of the OSS moved to Bern, Switzerland, to arrange the post-war Nazi links. And in 1943, the Nazis went underground. And I'll do more on them later. I just wanted to share you a little bit of that chronology this week about Henry Kissinger's military service in lieu of those dates. A World Watcher listener wrote to the Pentagon and also to Germany to get information about the German Fritz Kramer. And we have a little tiny bit about the American Fritz Kramer. If they're not the same person, I would be very shocked. But the statement from the military service of Henry Kissinger, just quickly, said that he was inducted into the Army of the USA February 26, 1943. That's just the time that William Casey was recruited by William Donovan to get into the OSS. Kissinger, February 28th, was inducted. He was transferred to the Enlisted Reserve Corps on the same date. He went into active duty March the 5th in 43. He went to Clemson College in July of 43. He went to Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. In 1944, he was assigned to the Company C 335th Infantry at Camp Claiborne in Louisiana, where he met Fritz Kramer, the German with the monocle, who recruited him in 1944 in April. And he departed the United States in September 29th, 1944, to go to European Theater, the 84th Counterintelligence Division. And Fritz Kramer was in the 84th Infantry Division. They were together. Now, they arrived in Europe in September 1944. The Battle of the Bulge, where the top Nazis merged with the United States Army, under the long-laid plans of Alan Dulles of the OSS and William Donovan and the Vatican and Ernest von Weizsäcker, and I'll be doing more on that later, took place just 3 months later. Kramer and Kissinger arrived in Europe in September 44. The Battle of the Bulge of the merger of the Nazis took place in 4 days from December 20th to 25th, 1944. And by January the 1st, William Casey and the OSS had all the top Liebsendart, the top Nazis, recruited that they could put in the Gestapo offices in Berlin, waiting for the official war to be over by May the 8th. The Army record said Kissinger was discharged May 23rd, 1946. So he had 2 nice years in Germany, and he was stationed in Frankfurt on Main, which is the home base of Peter Drucker, who brought Fritz Kramer to this country, and the notorious Fritz Kramer. He was located in Frankfurt, the Army paper said, and then he was appointed a second lieutenant of the military intelligence in 1948, and he went to Harvard as a part of the military, which is an interesting fact that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't read his military record. He went to Harvard College in 1947 under the military service, listed under military service from the Department of Defense. Henry Kissinger was there. He was at a city college in New York, 41 to 43, and he was in business administration with no degree. Whenever you want to know the profile of an agent in residence, whether it's a local one or a well-known one, you go through their chronology and you find what I call those missing 2 years where they get their training for their very important espionage work. And Kissinger's 2 years were 41 to 43 in business administration with no degree. If he's so action-oriented and so brilliant, he wouldn't have wasted his time unless he knew there was a future. 43 to 44, he was in an Army specialized training program as he connected with Fritz Kramer in Pennsylvania. And the military awards he got, he wasn't in any battle. Of course he wasn't in any battle, this Henry Kissinger, you can't visualize it. But the military awards he got for going over there, actually the 1st of October, and the war was over May. There was hardly after the Battle of Bulge any battle. The Germans merged with the Americans. Henry Kissinger got the Bronze Star Medal, the Good Conduct Medal, the American Campaign Medal, the European African Middle East Campaign Medal, which I don't know what that was for, but the Army says he got it. He got it with 3 Bronze Stars. He got the World War II Victory Medal, the Army of Occupation Medal with Germany. He got the Honorable Service Lapel Button for World War II And guess what? The sharpshooter badge with rifle and carbine bars, it reminds me of Lee Harvey Oswald as a sharpshooter in the Marines, Henry Kissinger, the sharpshooter. And then he got some overseas bars, and he got the meritorious unit of commendation, and then the French Croix de Guerre. So those were the list of his medals for the time that he sat over there in Europe. And then the same listener who got a pack of information on the German Fritz Kramer and on Henry Kissinger, a package of material, finds that Fritz Kramer, Hitler's favorite Nazi, who worked with Otto Skorzeny and Sepp Dietrich, who was in the Battle of the Bulge where the 6th Panzer Division merged with the American Army, where William Casey could pull his members of the Gestapo into the Berlin police offices. Hitler's top general only was in the army from 1943 up to the end of 1944. The army records have him June the 20th, 1943, and also January the 9th, 1943. So he became a top general with no background at all, and there's no record of what he did in a military sense. And that's the time period where I believe he was in the United States connecting up with Henry Kissinger and preparing what they would do with the world when the war was officially over. Hitler's top Fritz Kramer has no history of any operations in South Africa, Eastern Europe, Europe, France. His friend Sepp Dietrich has a military history going back to 1928, as do all the other people and defendants in the Dachau trial, but not Henry Kissinger, not Fritz Kramer, not Adolf Hitler's Fritz Kramer. He's only visible in the uniform 1943 and 44, and that's the time period where the American Kramer connects up with Henry Kissinger. For new listeners, and they're new listeners all the time, I'm updating a story of Hitler's top general, his favorite top general at the end of the war, a man named Fritz Kramer, and a man behind the career of Henry Kissinger, Alexander Haig, the mentor of Henry Kissinger, who I believe, for every reason that I can see and find, is the same person from Germany, from Frankfurt, Germany, who was sent to America to work with top, if you can call him an American. Henry Kissinger came from Perth, Germany in 1938 and was ready to connect with these people within a very short time. I've done many, many broadcasts on that, and if it's vague and you're new, you'll just have to bear with me, and if you want back broadcasts, they are available. Early in this year, I brought up the material around February of a item in the newspapers in Argentina that was covered on CNN News, that Adolf Hitler died this past January in Mendoza, Argentina, and a lot of the material is based on the work of a Dr. Robin Dorion, Director of Forensic Dentistry, Minister of the Solicitor General in Quebec, Montreal. There was a convention. And outside of World Watchers and CNN, this subject has been very suppressed. But Omni Magazine, this current issue, October 1987, page 39, has a picture of Hitler's imposter asking, was the corpse an imposter too? And asking, is the Hitler corpse a fraud? Did the Fuhrer make off to Argentina? And it implies that this particular Dr. Dorion from Canada seems to have the answer and knows, but he's not ready to put the speculation in public. But the evidence, the dental records of both Eva Braun and Adolf Hitler are absolutely ruled out if that was a source of identification and the corpse was not available in terms of identifying Hitler or Eva Braun. There were just a lot of ashes. Now, just one quick item or two on Fritz Kramer. Another listener got me some more material. One has to do, he was more public in 1966. Maybe he was around more, but I wasn't aware of him. But I received from somebody several pieces of news. One is a Rampart College newsletter, the Freedom School. Rampart College is a small college, and Fritz Kramer attended a policy on foreign affairs. This is back in 1966. He was with Frank Johnson, former Naval Intelligence Officer, Richard Allen of the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace. Allen became the first National Security Advisor for Ronald Reagan, and Sven Kramer, Fritz's son, was on the National Security Council, may still be, and Fritz Kramer was advising the Security Council in 1981, and Richard Allen and Fritz Kramer were speaking with a group including William Rickenbacker, the editor of National Review. That's owned by William Buckley, who set up Young Americans for Freedom in 1960 with not only William Buckley of the CIA, but Ronald Reagan on the board. And Fritz Kramer was part of the organization being a lecturer. Also, there was a newsletter from Freedom's Facts in December 1967, a symposium that talked about campus unrest. And the person giving the lecture or writing for this particular newsletter was Reed Irvine of Accuracy in Media. And I have linked him on other broadcasts to Fritz Kramer and the Intelligence Network. And also a seminar was conducted at St. Joseph's College by Dr. Fritz Kramer. This was in December of 1967. But then there was a report put out January 12, 1976, called Here and There, a Right-Wing Report, which I thought was particularly interesting for several reasons. It includes a newsletter regarding Fritz Kramer, but it was put out in conjunction with the National Association of Manufacturers, modeled after Sun Oil Company's plan to influence Federal Election Commission for the next election. And the head of Sun Oil, one of their executives, is Han Senholz, who's on the board of Western Goals. And then an item in this newsletter Here and There says, Pentagon defense scholar Dr. Fritz Kramer briefed the Senate staffers, of course, on the grim outlook of the Soviet Union and the Chinese Reds. And there's a paragraph on his speech against the Russians, the Soviets. And then the very last sentence of this very far right-wing newsletter that has nothing to do with anything but what the very right-wing are doing, it says, rumors reaching Washington from Minneapolis suggest that Hubert Humphrey's recent operation for bladder cancer was not entirely successful. Translated mean Hubert Humphrey would die of cancer. Now, in Germany, in the rearming of Germany from 1919 to 1929, there were the deaths of over 400 political persons who were wiped out that would oppose the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Reich. And so by 1933, Hitler could be elected. So I believe that cancer has been known to be a disease that can be transmitted with injections. And a lot of political people have died of cancer. Philip Hart of the Senate, Frank Church of the Senate, Jacob Javits had the Lou Gehrig's disease. And Hubert Humphrey was one of those wiped out by cancer. And what they have in this is a message that Humphrey's going to die of cancer. And I thought it was interesting putting it at the bottom of the newsletter that only cites these far right-wing groups and their speeches as if to give them a message. Now, when the listeners to World Watchers called the talk show of the program last week or the week before about Frank Carlucci, and he sent me a copy of what he was referring to that is very, very significant for the matter of Iran-Contra affairs in Washington, D.C. It comes out of Aviation Week in Space Technology, July 13th, 1987. Frank Carlucci, he describes himself, and there's a picture, chairman and CEO of Sears World Trade Incorporated. He doesn't say of the National Security Council. This is July 13th, 1987. He's been NSC director since January of 87. There's a picture of Carlucci, and it says, we need retired managers who are ready to roll up their sleeves again. I'm a volunteer supporter of the International Executive Service Corps, a not-for-profit organization with a vital mission. Just to stop there, Richard Secord was in the Air Force until 1983 when he officially resigned. Then he went working for these anti-terrorist covert operations that got involved with Iran and with Nicaragua and a lot of other countries also. And Secord was part of the government. He was, in quotes, not on the payroll. He was, in quotes, retired. But he and his gang, Secord and Hakim, have $8.6 million put away in Merrill Lynch in London that they're fighting to hold on to. So nonprofit for the moment becomes profit, and retired doesn't mean a thing, because you can retire from one branch of the government and still go on to another. Now, Carlucci said, we send retired U.S. managers overseas to help business in developing countries, which often respond by increasing their import of U.S. goods. In fact, developing countries consume 40% of the U.S. exports. Probably weapons, because Sears World Trade is a weapon manufacturer, and these people are not getting much except weapons for their money. The ad says, as an IESC volunteer, you would not get a salary, but you would get your expenses for you and your spouse, plus a world of personal satisfaction. IESC leads the field in this kind of work. We've done over 9,000 projects in 81 countries. We could have a project that's just right for you. To find out, send this coupon to Frank Carlucci, Chairman and CEO, Sears World Trade Company, P.O. Box 10005, Stamford, Connecticut, and it's got the zip code. Now, he isn't telling you or putting there that he is the National Security Advisor. This is the top spy agency with its little pocket. I call it Super Seize Me. It's gang that are so secret, even the NSC doesn't know what they're doing. He's running an ad here for what could be the massive amount of new secret team, new spies, because over Frank Carlucci, over him, is the mysterious, quiet, very seldom seen Eric von Marburg. When Carlucci was deputy secretary of the CIA under Jimmy Carter for 2 years, he then went on to be deputy director of the Defense Department for 2 years. Then he went on, after he was with Reagan, 1981 and 82, to represent Sears World Trade, where Eric von Marburg, the mysterious von Marburg, quietly recruited him. And this is an arms business. And von Marburg is linked to Stanford Technology Trading Group, to Richard Secord, Albert Hakim, to the group that were forming that company, EATSCO, that was sending arms to the Middle East after the Camp David Accord, with Thomas Klein, Theodore Shackley. And when they were going to be investigated, it was Michael Ledeen that went to the Justice Department that got them off. When Edwin Wilson was arrested and brought home from Switzerland, he was brought under the company of his friend Ernest Kaiser, or Robert Kaiser, he called himself. Then it turned out he was Ernest von Kaiser of the Wehrmacht. And with Fritz Kramer and Ernest von Kaiser, the question is, who is Eric von Marburg? The top researchers, including Danny Sheehan of Christic Institute, and Jim Hogan, who wrote Spooks, and Frank Turpel, who's in touch with Jim Hogan. The big secret, the question about Iran-Contra, has a lot to do with Eric von Marburg, so that this man can be recruiting out of the National Security Council to turn over the answers to Sears World Trade. He's running two operations at the same time that can go in the hands of von Marburg. And these men, if you can call them that, came out of Stanford Technology Training Group, which was formerly International Imaging, which belonged to Otto von Bolschring of the Waffen-SS, of the Gestapo, who set up his headquarters in California, who had his translator, his secretary to Reagan for 8 years out here. And I have to keep going back to that network of the secret team, because here is a man from the NSC using his name, using that company, for these purposes of setting up another secret team that can literally rape the third world, wipe out the middle class, kill the political opponents, have secret teams and death squads getting rid of all opponents to people, which they are doing, people like Pinochet and so forth. A man can be reelected because there's no middle class to stand up. There's no middle class in the Philippines to support a change after Marcos. So this is a very serious matter, and I appreciate the person who sent it to me, and I want to tell you to keep sending me that material. It's very nice. Now, I want to take this moment. We have a one-minute break here where I ask you to take notice of certain current things. A listener called me today and said that there's going to be a meeting at UC Santa Cruz. Dale Van Atta, the partner of Jack Anderson, will be speaking. October 13th, I can do more on the talk show part of the program. This is a week from Tuesday at Kresge College, UC Santa Cruz, and it's free. This is a chance to meet Mr. Van Alta, to ask questions, to open up new issues about Kramer or Kissinger, to get in their consciousness, and it would be a good chance for you to meet him and hear him. Jack Anderson does put out some very good material that nobody else dares to put out, and some of it is working with the CIA and so forth, but others, material is the most courageous in the country, and he consistently does it. And I'll take this one-minute break again to thank all of you. Subscribe.